Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box going to get sent back to sender. And now you're going to have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
You give me that funny feeling in my tummy. We'll be right back.
I used to spend the night in hotel parking lots. What was I going to do? I didn't have nowhere to stay, so I lived in the car. I had $35. And I said, come on, God, man, I've been trying to make this dream come true. You done left me out here like this. And I was crying so hard that he just said, I didn't like hear a voice or nothing, but he spoke to me, and however he said, if you get up, I'm going to take you places you ain't never been. Now, I was finna quit, so I said, skip it. I'm going to quit anyway. So I got in my car. I went to a payphone, and I was going to call my dad. You remember back in the day where you could punch in a code and call your answering machine and get your messages? So I called, and I punched in the code, and he said, doop. He said, hey, Steve, this is Chuck Sutton with Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of you. You're very funny. If you could get here Sunday night, we'd love to put you on television. Call me back. Let me know if you can make it. So I hung the phone up. I'm crushed because my whole dream of being on TV, and I couldn't get to New York. I got $35. How am I going to get to New York? I can't make it. So I'm standing there at the phone booth and tears just coming down my face. I said, God, so that must be a sign for me to go home. Because this it. I ain't even got the money to go to the Apollo. My whole thing, wanting to be on TV, I couldn't even make the dream come true. This is the most messed up moment. And so I said, man, let me call this dude back and see if he said this Sunday. Because maybe he said next Sunday, and I could hustle up a little bit of money or something. I don't know what I'm going to do, but let me just call him back. So I call him back. Steve, this is Chuck Sutton, Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of yours. You're very, very funny. Look, we have an opening Sunday night at Showtime at the Apollo. If you can make it, we'd love to put you on TV. I said, it's this Sunday. Before I hit the button, I heard, doop, you have another message. Now, it wasn't there before. So I punched my code in. I listened to the second message. It says, Steve Harvey, this is Tom Sober from the Comedy Caravan. This is a Thursday. He said, I have a gig in Jacksonville, Florida on Friday night that pays $150. If you can get there Friday night, you'll make $150. So I called him back and I said, hey, Tom, did you get a gig away? He said, no, it's still available. He said, can you get there? I said, I'm in Pensacola, Florida. I'm 3.5 hours away. So I drive to Jacksonville, Florida, and that night I made the 150. The club owner said, man, you're funnier than the guy we hired. If you stay tomorrow night, I'm going to give you another $150. So now I got $300 now. So I get on the phone. I call Chuck Sutton. I say, hey, man, is the gig still available at Showtime at the Apollo? He said, yeah, we got one opening left. I said, I'll be there. So I called Eastern Airlines, who used to be open back then. They had a special for $99 going from Jacksonville, Florida to New York round trip. So I parked my car at the airport. I got it. Got on plane, flew. Everything I had was in two bags. Got to the Apollo. I said, hey, man, I'm here. I got there at 11 o'clock in the morning. He said, you can't stay here because you don't come on to the late show tonight. I said, man, I ain't got nowhere to go. I said, if you just let me stay in this building, man, I ain't going to move around nothing. I ain't got nowhere to go. I'm in Harlem. I can't go back out here. I got these two bags. I got victim wrote all over me, man. So he said, all right, if you go upstairs, don't come down. So he put me in a dressing room on the sixth floor. So that's where all the comedians were. So I stayed up there. I got hungry around 3 o'clock, but I couldn't take it no more. So I went back downstairs, a dude named Alton Liston. I said, hey, man. He said, man, I thought I told you don't come down them damn steps. I said, hey, man, I'm just hungry, man. I said, let me go to that KFC I saw on the corner. Just let me get some chicken. I'll come right back. He said, man, if you ain't back in 20 minutes, you ain't getting in this building. So I went, bought me some chicken, came back. So the comedians started coming in the building. They start coming up on the sixth floor. So I meet this guy named D.L. Hughley. I introduce myself. He introduced himself. I'm sitting there. Another guy come in named Dwayne Johnson. Then this other dude walked in named Jamie Foxx. And I introduce myself. We don't know each other. Ain't none of us famous. It's 1991, man. They gave everybody the lineup. I was on the last show of the night. I don't go on to 11 at night. I'd have had this four pieces of chicken. I'm starving, man. That chicken done wore off. I'm nervous, man. I'm about to throw up. D.L. Hughley went downstairs. D.L. Hughley got booed off. Dwayne Johnson got booed off. Jamie Foxx went down there and got booed. They booed Jamie, then Jamie started singing. And then they started clapping. And Jamie had their ass, then he went back to them jokes, and they got his ass. So I'm walking down the steps, and I see Jamie sitting on the steps. I said, hey, man, hang in there. He said, man, that ain't never happened to me before, man. This is crazy. This is Jamie Foxx, man, one of the most talented people in all of comedy. And now, you don't even know how nervous I am, man. I can't even. My breathing is shot because these dudes been booed. So I walk out. I had wrote this joke. Mike Tyson had got in a fight in Harlem with this heavyweight named Mitch Green. Mike Tyson had hit the dude in the eye in the store. Now, he was on the news. His eye was swollen. So the joke I wrote was, they was interviewing Mitch Green, and he was telling everybody what happened, but his eye took over the interview. And I wrote this joke that his eye started talking and was just, I tell you what happened. The heavyweight champ's fist is coming towards my face. I just said, Lord, Lord, Lord. And I wrote this whole joke about this dude's eyeball talking. And when the punch came, and all this here, the Apollo, man, they went crazy. They lost their mind. I got a standing ovation, man. I walked off stage, man, just started crying. I couldn't believe it. They paid me. I made $750 for being on TV for one night. I'd never made $750 telling jokes in one night. And so that was my first television appearance. A couple weeks later, Sinbad was the host of the show. He got this job on Different World. And so he quit. And so Mark Curry became the host. And then Mark Curry got hanging with Mr. Cooper. And he quit. And they came to me and said, would you come back to New York and host Amateur Night for us to just try you out? Oh, ain't no problem. And so I went to New York. I hosted Amateur Night. And I was killing. But every time we went to commercial break, I was supposed to let the warm-up act take over like Ruben does. But I knew not to let the warm-up act do that because he would change the attitude of the crowd because the Apollo was a wild place. So I stayed out there. I did the warm-up and the hosting. And I created a bond with that audience. And that's how I got on TV. It was my very first TV show. I hosted Showtime at the Apollo. It ended up being the longest-running host in the history of Showtime. I did that show for 8 years. Nobody ever did it for 8 years. And that was my turn back moment. See, in your life, everybody has a turn back moment. You have a moment where you can go forward or you can give up. But the thing you have to keep in mind before you give up is that if you give up, the guarantee is it will never happen. That's the guarantee of quitting. That it will never happen, no way under the sun. The only way the possibility remains that it can happen is if you never give up no matter what. Because God is always coming. He's never too late. At your worst moment, look, man, when they told me I had to be in New York, I saw no way I could get there. But that God, though, he make the phone ring. I end up in Florida, I make $300. Then I go to New York, I make $750. Almost got $1,000. out of nowhere. That's what happened to me. That was my moment of never giving up. That's when I first learned that faith was everything, that you have to remain faithful.
And now, an exclusive first look at the upcoming documentary, 7 a.m.
Because true economic science is a branch of military science. War and money go hand in hand. Most wars are fights so people can make more money, and war is money. That means what? That the European American is not about to prepare black children to compete with his children for control of the economic sector. It's not going to happen. So if black people want this science, we got to teach it, we got to study it, and we're going to have to make some mistakes in perfecting it because we're still babies in the water of global economic commerce. As African people, we are financially illiterate. So we should not be surprised that we're so economically backward because we were never taught how to be economically forward. Our education in America has not provided or prepared us to be able to compete with Europeans economically. The historically black college was designed to do what? Teach you how to work for white people. Public schools, charter schools, parochial schools, independent schools. What is the purpose of education in America for black children right now? To teach them how to make a living working for white people. But I don't want the kids coming to my school to be going to class thinking that I'm learning this so I can go and get paid by a white person. They're going to be empowered to start their own business. When they leave that school, they're going to go into business. And why do we need our people to be self-sufficient? Because when you're not self-sufficient, you can't speak your mind. One of the biggest reasons why black people have been so cowardly in the post-civil rights movement, not standing up for ourselves, standing up for our children, standing up against police brutality, we're scared to lose our jobs. We have to work. We got kids. I can't talk about the racism on my job. I might lose it. So the reason why we're not speaking our mind is because we don't have economic freedom. As Mr. Garvey said, Marcus Garvey said, that a solid racial program must be built on a solid economic foundation. Show me your economic condition, and I'll show you your political condition. The political economy of the black community rests on the premise that because they do not make their own money, they are enslaved to Europeans. And as a result of that, they will never be able to do what needs to be done to carve out a future for their children, because the hand that pays is also the hand that rules them.
I support reparations. We're going to get reparations. Okay? But I got 5 issues with the reparations movement.
Okay, can we hear?
Issue number 1. I haven't seen any accounting with regard to the psychological damage that was done to African people. All I see is a focus on 243 years of unpaid labor. That's important, but that 243 years of unpaid labor is nothing compared to 400 years of psychological terrorism.
Yes.
Where is the accounting for the psychological damage? You understand?
I understand.
Why do successful black men marry outside of their race more than all other men put together marry outside of this? Psychological terrorism of white supremacy. Why do most black women feel in order to be beautiful, they got to put somebody else's hair on their head? That's psychological terrorism. Why do successful black people feel they have to live in a white suburb to feel like they've made it? That's psychological terrorism. You see, that is the continual residual side effects of Ma'afa, i.e. post-traumatic slavery disease. You can pay us for 243 years, but that does nothing to undo the menticide. We need an accounting on the psychological damage that was done to the African, and that psychological damage is worth 100 times more than the unpaid labor. Number 2, if we're going to talk about reparations, it cannot stop with 1865 and the 13th Amendment. Or are we going to let them off the hook for the last 154 years of the same thing?
Yeah.
See, don't stop this at 1865. Bring it all the way up to 2019. And one of the things that must be accounted for and restored and repaired is the fact that white folks have stolen tens of thousands of acres of black land in this country at gunpoint that we are entitled to get back. So where is the conversation about returning the stolen land back to black folks? See, we dealing with gentrification, right? They pushing us out of our neighborhood. But how much of those neighborhoods they pushing us out of were actually owned by black folks 100 years ago? There must be a reclamation of the land. Next, I haven't seen anybody mention the Arabs and the role that they played in the slavery. The Arabs were trading slaves before the white man, and they still trade them to this very day. Are we only dealing with the British? What about the Arabs? Deal with everybody.
Right.
Next, there was one slave. But all of the reparations movements are divided like tribes. There's an English reparations for the slaves of Europe. There's a North American reparations for the slave of America. The Caribbean have their own reparations. Africa got their own reparations. Why do you have all these different reparations movements when there was one slavery that took us from one place? The reparations movement needs to be unified or it will fail. Why? Because the slave master will play us against each other so none of us get nothing. Let me give you an example. If America says you owe us $20 billion, hypothetically, and Jamaica says you owe us $40 billion, white man going to say, well, if I owe black America $20, how can I possibly owe you $40? In other words, if we don't collaborate with the arguments, they'll be able to expose contradictions in all of our arguments, and none of us will get nothing. So there must be a unity of movement. Last thing. I don't want any money from America for reparations, because American money ain't worth anything. It's not backed by gold. It's not backed by diamonds. It's not backed by silver. I don't want no... The worst thing we could do is take a check from America, because America's money is only a promissory note. So what do you mean, Doc? I'm saying that the reparations should take the form of things and assets and privileges and resources and rights that can never expire. Why? Okay. Because the benefit of slavery to America can never expire. So whatever we accept as payment for it should equally never expire. I want control over certain land forever, certain waterways forever, certain resources forever, certain institutions forever. Because America will forever benefit from me, so I should forever benefit from her.
That's fire right there.
Before there can be external reparations, there must be internal restoration. I want y'all to hear this. One other point I'm going to disagree on with the Queen, respectfully. Money will not save us. I know, but hear me. Hear me. Right, but hear me. But you said the money would help us. No, it won't. Okay. People argue that the money will help us, not you, but people argue that the money will help. I'm here to tell y'all, listen to me now. I don't care how much money they give you in reparations, and I've already made it clear I don't want any money, right? It won't help you. Do you want to know why? Because the problem of the Negro is profoundly psychological. It's not monetary. You blow $2 trillion a year. You blow $2 trillion a year. So is the reparations dollar any different than the ones you already got in your pocket? What are you going to do differently with the reparations check than what you're doing now? Let me tell you. Let me say this. I'm for reparations. I want to be clear. But what I'm for first is for us to not be so thirsty for a check and look within the community and build infrastructure. Because if the black dollar doesn't circulate not even one time before it leaves, how fast do you think your reparations dollars are going to leave? Do you realize we don't have any infrastructure or businesses to track the money? In other words, the Chinese can't wait till you get reparations. Mercedes-Benz can't wait till you get reparations. I heard they're going to open up a reparations hair store and have a reparations weave sale. I heard Foot Locker going to have an Air Jordan reparations special for all you Negroes. Because as soon as you get your check, you're going to take it straight to white folks and Chinese. All I'm saying is, we're entitled to it. We will get it. But I would hope that we would care enough about our great-grandkids, great-grandkids, to build the infrastructure that can trap the money inside before we get it. Otherwise, we're going to blow it, and we only got one chance.
Train call. Said to tell you you're going to be late behind something he needs to see down the way.
So what you're telling me, we weak?
Boss, I reached out to Black Donnie.
Okay, spit it out, man. Listen, stop fucking double talking me.
Black Donnie say he ain't having any of it. Say Brother Muzon put a hex on all of us.
What about Peacock?
Peacock went and hired out with some Dominicans.
What about Eggie Mule?
Hey, Eggie locked up, caught a nickel with the feds for a pistol.
What about Shorty Boy?
Shorty Boy went and cleaned his old act up. Yeah, I know. Fucked us all up.
What we got?
Soldier you sent at us, Cuddy, he gonna work out. But the rest of them dudes, I don't know.
All right, listen, big man. You're about to earn your fucking keep around here right now. You go out, you get Cuddy, and get the best of the rest, and you put a hurting on Marlo. I want my corners.
All right, look. Me and Slim, we're going to work through the alleys and hit them from the side. I want you to come through here. Slow down through the intersection.
Oh, why don't we just come up this way that we ain't got to worry about crossing no intersection?
Come that way? You putting your driver in the line of fire, man. Think on it. He getting taken out. Car going to crash. Now, where that put you at?
Besides, you don't want to be shooting across your driver, do you? All right, so come in easy. They ain't going to be looking for you because we're going to have their full attention.
Now look, pick your targets, drop them, and move out quick. Who driving me?
I'm under the wheel. All right, you make sure you slow down at the end of the block and toss your weapons.
And get rid of any shell casings that kick back in the car. Police can trace them shits.
Toss the gloves too, right?
Nah, hold on to them. They're going to have that DNA shit all on them. All
right, look, it's going to take us some time to get set up. So we need y'all to lay back about 4 or 5 blocks. And when we ready, we're going to hit you on the burner. But y'all hold tight till I call you. You got it?
We're going to handle our end. You just make sure some fucking rope left out there for us.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't want to feel like I'm just some damn decoy.
Damn right about that. We should wait for the call. Man, what if that crew got lookout?
Motherfucker, if we waited, it'd be all over time we get there. Man, plus, look, man, I'm saying, how's that gonna play with Avon, man? They taking all the credit.
Yo, fellas, strap up.
Go that motherfucking Nene, man. I say we take him.
We should wait for the call.
Man, we wait. He gonna get away, man.
Go.
Say something about waiting for a fucking phone call.
Is Last seen Gerard, man, he was racing bullets up on Fayette Street. He appeared to be winning, too.
Look, man, till he shows back up here, we ain't gonna know what happened out there.
I damn sure know one fucking thing for sure. Two of our people talked, and we ain't got shit to show for it.
Man, police gonna be real heavy on this, man. I say we slow down, take our time to build our muscle up.
No, I ain't got no more motherfucking time, man. When the work comes, this boy Marlo punking me, what I'ma look like? I'ma go do this shit my damn self.
Nah, man, you just this minute got home. Your name come up in a murder beef, man, they gonna pull your parole. Let me take care of this.
We was thinking, man, me and Cuddy, you know what I'm saying, we can hit them by ourselves, man. That way, won't be no fuck-ups.
Look, you two niggas get on it, man. And get it right.
And that was from The Wire. Today's podcast is titled Gentrification Chess. Gentrification Chess. Avon Barksdale wanted to fight over corners, but he didn't own those corners. And the ways that you can legally own corners and don't have to do things that are illegal. In any event, it's MLK Day, a holiday here. I guess it's kind of slow out there today. If you got any requests, trending topics, anything you want to discuss, 619-768-2945. That's 619-768-2945. We'll be back after this.
This is the city, Los Angeles, California. 464.8 square miles of real estate. It takes a lot of departments and agencies to keep it going. Fire, water and power, education, health. There's a department of airports, a harbor department, and libraries. There's also a department for law and order. This is Parker Center. I work here. I carry a badge. It was Monday, June 29th. It was warm in Los Angeles. We were working the day watch out of homicide. The boss is Captain Brown. My partner's Bill Gannon. My name's Friday. Mrs. Lily Burnham, a real estate broker, has been reported missing. The preliminary investigation indicated a strong possibility of foul play.
The story you are about to see is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
I drove over to the offices of the Burnham Realty Company, 9.05 a.m.
Good morning. May I help you?
Police officers, this is Bill Gannon. My name's Friday.
I'll tell Mr. Richmond you're here.
Thank you.
I'll just be a moment.
Oh, take a look at this, Joe. Beautiful home, isn't it?
Yeah.
You can tell quality construction. 3+10, 2 baths, built-ins. What do you figure the asking is?
The what?
The asking price. How much for this one?
Well, I wouldn't have any idea.
Got to be 42.5. Probably take 39.7 today's market.
Is that right?
You bet. I know the market pretty good.
You do, huh?
Every Sunday we go for a drive. Eileen will watch for open houses, you know, furnished models.
Yeah.
We stop and go through them, spend the whole afternoon. We've seen some great buys, Joe.
Well, I didn't know you were interested in a new house.
What makes you say that?
Well, I mean, you're out looking at all those great buys.
Well, you've been out to my place.
That's right.
What's wrong with the house I've got?
Sergeant Friday, this is Mr. Richmond, one of our salesmen.
Sergeant.
My partner, Officer Bill Gannon.
Well, you gentlemen aren't here to buy a house, so I better let you do the talking.
Wonder if we could have your name, miss.
That's right, Miss Walters. Ida Walters.
And you filed a missing report, did you?
Well, yes, sir. I'm Mrs. Burnham's secretary.
Ida phoned it in, Sergeant, on my say-so.
How long has she been missing?
From our happy little circle since Friday afternoon. Went out to show some property about 2 o'clock.
2:15. I saw her drive away.
Did you? Well, then, Ida must have been the last one to see her.
She didn't even phone in again.
Was that unusual?
Yes, sir.
The weekend, gentlemen. That's when we move houses. A man and wife, generally, they can't get out together during the week, so we spend Saturdays and Sundays sitting in a furnished model, wheeling and dealing, you know.
Yes, sir.
Now, you take Miss Lily. She's a businesswoman. Nothing would keep her from a weekend of wheeling and dealing.
Something did.
Yeah, that's why we reported it.
Maybe she's sick.
I called her apartment house. Somebody looked in.
Yes, ma'am.
They don't think she's been there all weekend.
She might have gone out of town. Has that ever happened before?
Not on a weekend.
Does she have relatives?
There's a sister, I think, in Philadelphia. Nobody out here.
Well, there must have been a husband at one time. What about him?
He's never mentioned.
All right. Does she have a boyfriend?
There's Terry Williams, but it looks like he doesn't know anything either.
Mr. Williams been calling us two or three times on Friday and again this morning.
I see. Well, maybe there's somebody else.
Wouldn't matter, Sergeant.
Well, how's that?
She had an appointment this morning to close the deal. No man will ever stand between Lily and the commission, or a woman either.
Maybe that's the secret of her success.
You have to understand, gentlemen, Ida is the president of the Miss Lily fan club. I work here just for money. It gives us different perspectives.
Do you need me for anything else?
We'll need a description of Mrs. Burnham.
Well, she's attractive, I guess, if you lack them cold and ruthless. Age, what would you say, Ida?
About 36.
Yeah, 36 going on 42. But she's kept her figure and knows how to dress.
You remember what she was wearing Friday?
Your department, Ida.
It was her paisley linen dress. Over it, she wore a matching linen coat.
What color?
The dress was orange and yellow, and the coat was yellow.
Mm-hmm.
And bone leather shoes with a matching purse. It's very smart.
Yes, ma'am. Anything else?
No, except we're all terribly worried. It's just not like Mrs. Burnham. She must have had an accident or something.
Something has kept her away, but knowing our Lily...
Yeah.
I doubt it was an accident.
Before leaving the realty office, we learned that Terry Williams, the missing woman's boyfriend, was the day bartender at a bar on West Adams. We also obtained the make, model, and license number of Mrs. Burnham's car. 10:50 a.m., we went back to the office, and after checking R&I, we put out a teletype describing the vehicle with a request that, if observed, to notify Homicide Division. 11:05 a.m., we drove over to West Adams to interview Terry Williams, Mrs. Burnham's boyfriend.
Good morning.
Terry Williams.
That's right.
Police officers.
Mm-hmm. It's about Lily Burnham, isn't it?
That's right.
Only thing it could be. The secretary said they were going to report it if she didn't show up soon. Guess she hasn't, huh?
When did you see her last?
Thursday night. We had dinner, a couple of drinks. Broke it up early.
See her over the weekend?
No, sir.
You didn't make a date with her?
Nothing definite. Said I'd call. Maybe we'd get together.
Did you call?
A few times. Got no answer.
How long have you known Mrs. Burnham?
Guess it must be close to a year now.
She got any other boyfriends that you know of?
Don't see how she could. We were together most of the time.
But not over the weekend?
That's right. Because she wasn't in when I called. I explained all that.
Would you happen to have a photograph of her?
No, sir.
Use the phone. Do you know if Mrs. Burnham carried a lot of cash?
She was never short, but not enough to go very far. That's what you're thinking.
That's not what I'm thinking.
Robbery? How much do you need to get mugged these days?
Not very much.
Excuse me. Got a customer down here.
Nothing on Williams. Local boy. Clean all the way through high school. Yeah. Mrs. Burnham's car turned up. They want it moved before tonight. They need the space. Who's that? Car's in a restaurant parking lot.
A.M. According to the parking lot attendant, the car had been discovered on the lot Saturday morning. It was first assumed the owner, deciding he was incapable of driving, had gone home in a cab and would return for it the next day. When it was still there 48 hours later, it was reported abandoned.
Book of real estate listings.
Keys are in the ignition.
Gas receipt, Mrs. Lily Burnham, 17 gallons.
Tank's almost full. Where'd she buy the gas?
Station out near Hanson Dam.
12 noon. Before leaving the lot, we arranged to have Mrs. Burnham's car gone over by SID. An examination of the loose leaf book revealed 8 listings in the Hanson Dam area. 12:20 p.m., we interviewed the attendant at Jackson and Martin's Super Service. After hearing a description of Mrs. Burnham in her car, he thought he remembered her from last Friday. He was almost certain there had been a man in the car with her, but he was unable to give us any description of him. We got a copy of the recent listings from the Burnham Realty Company. We also picked up a set of keys for the houses. 12:35 p.m., we started checking the various listings. The occupants of the houses told us Mrs. Burnham had not been there at any time in the past month. 12:48 p.m., the third house we checked was vacant and still for sale.
What was that number, 1223?
That's right.
Yeah, here we are.
Cigarette butts, lipstick on them. Could have been here a long time.
Yeah, I'll check the rest of the place.
Bill. Orange and yellow linen dress, bone shoes, matching handbag.
Yep.
Mrs. Lily Burnham. p.m. In answer to our request, a field supervisor and two radio units arrived at the scene. One unit was stationed at the end of the street to keep out curious onlookers. The other was sent to cruise the area in the hopes of locating witnesses. Men from SID were also dispatched. The room was dusted for fingerprints. Photographs, both in black and white and color, were taken of the victim.
You want to take a look at this now? Outside was wiped clean. $50 in bills.
Inside's pretty neat, isn't it?
Yeah, it doesn't look like anybody prowled it. Usual stuff in it. Compact lipstick, nail file, comb.
Yeah. Better take these beads along. They're broken.
I was just thinking.
Yeah?
This purse, the stuff in it. Not like my wife's.
What do you mean?
You know what's missing? Credit cards.
Well, we know she had a gas card.
Not anymore, she doesn't.
p.m. The radio unit, which had been cruising the area, had located a possible witness. Frank Stobie, a local handyman, told us that while riding past the house on his bicycle at roughly 2:30 p.m. the previous Friday, he had seen a man and a woman approaching the front entrance. He described the victim's clothing with reasonable accuracy, but he could not recall any details about the man. 5:20 p.m. Bill and I decided to re-interview the victim's boyfriend, Terry Williams. At the Red Quill Bar, we were told that he had already left for the day. We got his home address.
Okay, what is it? What do you want this time?
We want to talk to you again.
Did you find Lily?
We'd like you to come downtown with us, Williams.
So she's dead.
What makes you say that?
It's true, isn't it?
You got a coat?
Are you guys arresting me?
No, we just want to get some more information.
Okay. Let me wash my face.
All right.
Joe? Take a look.
I can just get a clean shirt on.
You look fine.
Then you're not taking me in.
Now listen carefully. You have the right to remain silent. Any statements you make can and will be used against you in a court of law. Do you understand that?
Then you are arresting me.
You have the right to the presence of an attorney. If you cannot afford one, one will be appointed without charge before any questioning.
Do you understand that?
Yeah, I understand. I just want to know why.
Well, that makes us even.
Hmm?
We just want to know why you've got those four beads.
Oh, I can explain those.
Suppose you do that.
Thursday night. I told you about it. It was my birthday. Lily took me to dinner. Afterwards, we came over here for a little while.
Go on.
She broke her beads. Or maybe I did. One way or the other, the string got busted. I fixed it for her and thought all the beads were on it. But when I sacked out for the night, those four turned up.
Where did they turn up?
On the couch. Except one I found in the cuff of my slacks. Now, that's the truth.
Maybe. But you didn't tell us all that this morning.
I didn't think it was important then.
Why do you think it is now?
p.m. Terry Williams was booked for murder. Under interrogation, he made several conflicting statements. He admitted that last Thursday was not his birthday and that Lily Burnham had been in the habit of picking up all their tabs. He also admitted they had quarreled that night, but he continued to deny having seen her after she left his apartment around midnight. He could not satisfactorily account for his whereabouts at the approximate time of the murder. 8.05 p.m., the suspect agreed to undergo a polygraph examination. It was conducted by Lieutenant W.L. Klingon. 11.30 p.m., we were given the results of the examination.
First, let me say there were strong patterns indicating deception. For instance, a good reading on the money in the victim's billfold.
He knew how much?
On the nose. It's possible she always carried exactly $50. Some people limit themselves to a certain amount.
Yeah.
Also, a good response on the clothes she was wearing, the string of beads getting broken in a quarrel, and the general location of the crime.
What location?
Handsome Dam area. I'll return to that in a minute. I got a positive reading on the victim's death by strangulation. Now, let me ask you a question, Joe, Bill. Where was she killed?
What do you mean, Lieutenant?
Could she have been murdered somewhere else and her body moved into the house?
No, we didn't find any evidence to suggest that. None at all.
Specifically in the victim's car, parked somewhere in an alley.
You got that reaction from Williams?
Very strongly, and it was dark, rather late at night.
We've got a good witness placing the victim at the house about 2:30 Friday afternoon. We think she was strangled shortly after. Coroner might confirm the time, Joe. Yeah, we'll know after the post tomorrow.
All right, let's get back to this reaction on Hanson Dam. Could he have known she was going out there?
Well, the victim might have mentioned it the night before.
Well, I have to tell you, I got no indication at all that he knows the location of the house, or that he took her car, or that he knew where the car was found abandoned.
He just doesn't know the right things, does he? And yet he reacted to her being dead by strangulation.
That's true, but a woman being strangled in a car parked in an alley is a fairly common scene in mystery novels or on TV. Or he could have been reacting to the way he would have done it.
You mean he might have just played back to you something he'd read?
Or saw in a movie, say, in the last 24 hours. And didn't they quarrel Thursday night in his apartment?
Yeah, according to him.
Well, she got loud and disturbed the other tenants. Well, Williams may have wished he could quiet her down.
I see. Well, what's your best opinion, Lee?
Looks to me like you've got some work to do.
Yeah, how's that?
I don't think he's a good suspect.
Tuesday, June 30th, we attended the postmortem on Lily Burnham. The coroner confirmed that death was due to manual strangulation. He fixed the time of death somewhere between 2 p.m. and 4 p.m. the previous Friday. There was no evidence of sexual assault. On the basis of this information, Terry Williams was cleared and released. 11:30 a.m., Bill and I went back to the office. Bill contacted the real estate secretary, Ida Walters, and asked if she would check Lily Burnham's charge accounts. Miss Walters agreed and said she'd let us know. Friday, July 3rd, in response to a message from Ida Walters, we drove over to the Burnham Realty Company, 2:20 p.m.
I'm sorry I took so long.
That's all right, Miss Walters.
I knew Mrs. Burnham had many charge accounts, but nobody can find any cards or charger plates or anything, unless you found them with her.
No, ma'am, we don't have them.
Well, the only thing I could do was go through the files and look for old receipts and then verify that these accounts were still active.
Yeah.
It was the least I could do for... Anyway, it took time.
What did you find?
Two service station cards, diners club, carte blanche, an air travel card, just about all the major department stores, and Bank America card. I made this list.
Thank you.
Sergeant, is it true what the papers say that Mrs. Burnham was... It happened last Friday afternoon?
Yes, ma'am. It's been verified.
Then I'm right.
How do you mean?
This statement just came in today from Barton's Wilshire. It shows that Mrs. Burnham bought a diamond wristwatch for over $400. At first, I thought the store had made a mistake.
But you called the store, did you?
Yes, sir. They said there was no mistake. They were very positive. I knew then that there was something wrong. I mean, it just isn't possible. Mrs. Burnham couldn't put a charge in her account the day after she was... Excuse me.
All right, whoever it was stole her credit cards. Figured that way he'd buy a lot of stuff that he could sell off later. He'd need a woman to use those cards.
That's right.
Made an appointment with Mrs. Burnham to look at a house. Got her alone.
Yeah.
Then he killed her.
...4 p.m., a description of the suspect's M.O. was circulated to all police departments. A different version of this bulletin was sent to a real estate trade journal for publication. Tuesday, July 7th, A response to our bulletin came in from Phoenix, Arizona.
Man identified as Carl Keegan, alias William Simpson, victimized 9 women in Phoenix. Same M.O., stole credit cards.
Yeah, what about the description?
Good one. This Keegan's wanted on a fugitive warrant.
Yeah.
He jumped bail down there.
1 week passed. Tuesday, July 14th. We got a call from Sergeant Jack Williams, Robbery Division. He said he thought he might have something for us. Bill and I went down to the robbery squad room to see him.
Friday, Gannon.
Jack, how's it going?
Jack, I'm playing. Got a bank series going that's keeping us on the run.
Is that right?
A couple of on-ramp specialists. They're really hitting pretty good.
You said you might have something for us.
Yeah, on that realty thing you guys are working.
What do you got?
Just got back in from talking to this woman. Lady realtor down near Inglewood. Name's Roy, Ardith Roy.
Yeah, what about her?
Says about 4 days ago, she was out showing a house to a prospective buyer. Said the guy appeared interested in the house and told her he'd check back with her about making a deal in a few days.
Yeah.
Roy woman said she wrote it off as a no sale. The guy left her at the empty house. She locked up and started back for her office. On the way back, she stopped for a tank of gas. When she went to give the attendant her credit card, she noticed it was gone. Not only her gas card, but all of her cards.
Now, the man she was showing the house to, did he give a name?
Yeah, Simpson. William Simpson.
She gave you a description?
Yeah. It's all down here. There's more.
Go ahead.
Well, she figured until today, maybe she just lost the cards or misplaced them. She finished checking her morning mail. That's why she called in.
Yeah.
She got a bill from Mallard, you know, the sporting goods store?
Yeah.
Well, the bill was for $780. Most she ever bought there was a catcher's mitt for her son's birthday.
Did you check the store?
Yeah. Clerk remembers a rather nice-looking girl who charged the stuff. He asked for identification. The girl showed him all the other credit cards, so naturally, he didn't question the purchase. Big store. Doubtful if anybody would know the Roy woman on site.
That it?
Well, that's it. Whoever you're looking for, sorry I can't serve him up on a plate, but it ties, doesn't it?
Sure sounds like it, Jack. Now, this realtor, she say anything about the man's behavior?
She said he appeared courteous, looked the house over carefully, appeared straight enough to her.
How'd this Simpson get to her purse, she say?
Told her she left it on the kitchen sink. The two of them wandered through the house. When they got to one of the back bedrooms, the guy said he'd like to take one more look at the kitchen. She stayed in the bedroom, and he went to the kitchen by himself.
Thanks, Jack.
Got anything going for you?
We put a notice in the Real Estate Trade Journal. About all we can do is wait and hope it brings rain.
And in the meantime, there are a lot of empty houses to show.
And a lot of credit cards to steal.
Wednesday, July 22nd, 10:45 a.m. We got our first break.
Woman realtor out of Pacoima just phoned in. Name's Esther Jenkins. Saw her notice in the trade journal. Says she's got a date to show a house in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Description fits Keegan.
11:15 a.m. We arrived at the address given us by the realtor who had telephoned in. Mrs. Esther Jenkins.
I think you'll really enjoy the
home.
It seems to have everything you're looking for.
Yes, I believe this is just what I want.
Hello. Would you gentlemen like to see the house?
Police officers.
Stand still.
You're Esther Jenkins?
That's right.
Just a moment. I don't think you have a right to do this.
We have a right to look at your identification.
And I'm entitled to know why.
You've been the route. There's a fugitive want on you. You jumped bail in Arizona. Let's have your name.
William Simpson.
Miss Jenkins, are you carrying any credit cards?
Yes, I am.
Would you mind showing them to us?
No, not at all. I always carry them with me. That's strange. I had them just a few minutes ago.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm positive. I always carry them with me.
I hope you're not accusing me of taking them.
Well, now, maybe your name's Esther Jenkins. That's what it says on these credit cards.
You can't do a thing until I talk to my attorney.
Miss Jenkins?
Yes. Those are mine, all right.
All right, put your hands behind your back.
Just a minute. Who do you think you're pushing around?
We're not pushing you around, but since you don't seem to know, I'll tell you what your name is. It's Carl Keegan. You killed a realtor by the name of Lily Burnham, just like you would have this woman if she'd found out you stole these cards.
You can't prove any of that.
Well, we're going to try.
You made a mistake, and I'm not going to pay for it.
You're going to use a credit card?
Just seen is true. The names were changed to protect the innocent.
On September 20th, trial was held in Department 185, Superior Court of the State of California for the County of Los Angeles. In a moment, the results of that trial. The The suspect was found guilty of murder in the first degree. Murder in the first degree is punishable by death or confinement in the state prison for life at the discretion of the court or jury trying the same. Subsequent investigation led to the identification and arrest of Carl Keegan's female accomplice, who was tried and found guilty on 5 counts of forgery. Forgery is punishable by imprisonment in the state prison for not less than 1 year, nor more than 14 years, or by imprisonment in the county jail for not more than 1 year.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. I mean, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 apiece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude. That bitch good, nigga. Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She drug you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass. She a nigga. That nigga hurting himself. You from New State.
It's over. It's over. When I say it's over, everybody
get
the fuck out of here.
Man, fuck it. Let's go
across
the street.
Because I ain't caught it. I'll slap the fuck out of one of y'all.
Real quick. Just like this.
He
brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you could do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns. Because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations, like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield. See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, The Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-Civil Rights Movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them, which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place. There's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you. Take the bottom 20 worst communities in the U.S., okay?
Okay.
Take bottom 20. I want to hear what you're going to say about this. Bottom 20. It's a required reading to read those three books before fifth grade.
Absolutely.
Let's just say we do that. And let's do the math for those kids. Bottom. It's 100,000 kids. Let's just say it's a small number, 100,000 kids. If they were required to read Richest Man in Babylon, Think and Grow Rich, As a Man Think It, right?
Right.
Before sixth grade, if they were required to read that, you think how big of a difference you think it would have made percentage-wise?
Tremendous. Tremendous.
What is tremendous on 100,000 percentage-wise?
Probably 90%.
You think that big of a number?
I think so.
That's a big number you're talking about. So let me ask you, how come our politicians aren't recommending kids to read books?
Well, how come we're not recommending some of these books for us to read?
Well, I don't really know the community. They never go in the community. We have people making decisions for us that has never been in the community. Like, we have people who make laws that have never been to a jail. Like, how can you tell how much time a person should spend in prison when you've never been to the prison? You don't know what it's like to go to prison. They never come to our communities. They never get out to
you think
meet.
You have to go to jail to be able to know how to influence you? No. I mean, it's kind of like saying, I'm a gynecologist, but I'm a man. I've never had a kid. The reason why I don't want to use that is because they'll use that as an excuse. What I'm saying is, why aren't they creating opportunity? Myself, okay, I'm a math kid. I had a 1.8 GPA in high school, okay? If I was in your community, I'm probably running with you.
Right.
But my savior was Army, because a guy named Jesus Guerin came and told me, says, you're headed towards that side, probably part of your life. And he signed me up for the Army. I went to the Army. Life changed.
Right.
I was working at Burger King. I'm like a regular guy doing nothing, right? But the reason why I asked that is I'm trying to see, one, I rarely ever hear any campaign, any politician talk about, let's have our kids read the right books.
They don't. I totally agree. I mean, even my book, I've had teachers read my book, and they ask me, why am I so blunt in my book? And I said, because our kids are tired of BS.
Good morning.
What's up, guys? I'm Olivia.
And I'm Kyle.
And we're Driving and Vibing.
Today's video is all about boondocking, where we're going to be answering your questions, so stay tuned.
Welcome back to our channel, everyone. Thank you guys so much for joining us today. If you haven't noticed, we are out
I'd like to take you to another world, and I'd like to share a 45-year-old love story with the poor living on less than $1 a day. I went to a very elitist, snobbish, expensive education in India, and that almost destroyed me. I was all set to be a diplomat, teacher, doctor, all laid out. I don't look it, but I was the Indian national squash champion for 3 years. The whole world was laid out for me. Everything was on my feet. Could do nothing wrong. And then I thought, out of curiosity, I'd like to go and live in a work, just see what a village is like. So in 1965, I went to what was called the worst Bihar famine in India, and I saw starvation, death, people dying of hunger for the first time. Changed my life. Came back home, told my mother, I'd like to live and work in a village. Mother went into a coma. What is this? The whole world is laid out for you, the best jobs are laying out for you, and you want to go and work in a village? I mean, is there something wrong with you? I said, no, I've got the best education, it made me think, and I wanted to give something back in my own way. What do you want to do in a village? No job, no money, no security, no prospect. I said, I want to live and dig wells for 5 years. Dig wells for 5 years? You went to the most expensive school and college in India and you want to dig wells for 5 years? She didn't speak to me for a very long time because she thought I'd let my family down. But then I was exposed to the most extraordinary knowledge and skills that very poor people have, which is never bought into mainstream, which is never identified, respected, applied on a large scale. And I thought I'd start a barefoot college only for the poor. What the poor thought was important would be reflected in the college. Went to this village for the first time. Elders came to me and said, "Are you running from the police?" I said, "No." "You failed in your exam?" I said, "No." "You didn't get a government job?" I said, "No." "What are you doing here? Why are you here? The education system in India makes you look at Paris and Delhi and Zurich. What are you doing in this village? Is there something wrong with you not telling us?" He said, "No. I want to actually start a college only for the poor. What the poor thought was important would be reflected in the college." So then they gave me some very sound and profound advice. They said, "Please, don't bring anyone with a degree and qualification into your college." So it's the only college in India where if you should have a PhD or a master's, you're disqualified to come. You have to be a cop-out or a washout or a dropout to come to our college. You have to work with your hands. You have to have a dignity of labor. You have to show that you have a skill that you can offer to the community and provide a service to the community. So we started the Barefoot College, and we redefined professionalism. Who is a professional? A professional is someone who has a combination of competence, confidence, and belief. A water diviner is a professional. A traditional midwife is a professional. A traditional bone setter is a professional. These are professionals all over the world. You'll find them in any inaccessible village around the world. And we thought that these people should come into mainstream and show that the knowledge and skills that they have is universal. It needs to be used, needs to be applied, needs to be shown to the world outside that these knowledge and skills are relevant even today. So the college works following the lifestyle and work style of Mahatma Gandhi. You eat on the floor, you sleep on the floor, you work on the floor. There are no contracts, no written contracts. You can stay with me for 20 years, go tomorrow. And no one can get more than $100 a month. You come for the money, you don't come to Barefoot College. You come for the work and the challenge, you come to the Barefoot College. That is where we want you to try crazy ideas. Whatever idea you have, come and try. Doesn't matter if you fail. Battered, bruised, you start again. It's the only college where the teacher is the learner and the learner is the teacher. And it's the only college we don't give a certificate. You are certified by the community you serve. You don't need a paper to hang on the wall to show that you are an engineer. So when they said that, they said, "Well, show us what is possible. What are you doing? This is all mumbo jumbo if you can't show it on the ground." So we built the first Barefoot College in 1986. It was built by 12 barefoot architects who can't read and write. Built on $1.50 a square foot. 150 people lived there, worked there. They got the Aga Khan Award for Architecture in 2002. But then they suspected, they thought there was an architect behind it. I said, "Yes, they made the blueprints, but the Barefoot architect actually constructed the college. We are the only ones who actually returned the award for $50,000 because they didn't believe us, and we thought that they were actually casting aspersions on the Barefoot architects of Thelonia. I asked a forester, high-powered, paper-qualified expert, I said, "What can you build in this place?" He had one look at the soil and said, "Forget it, no way, nothing can work. No water, rocky soil." I was in a bit of a spot, and I said, "Okay, I'll go to the old man in the village and say, what should I grow in this spot?" He looked quietly at me and said, "You build this, you build this, you put this, and it'll work. This is what it looks like today." Went to the roof, and all the women said, "Clear out. The men should clear out because we don't want to share this technology with the men. This is waterproofing the roof. It is a bit of jaggery, bit of urine, and a bit of other things I don't know, but it actually doesn't leak. Since 1986, it hasn't leaked. This technology, the women will not share with the men." It's the only college which is fully solar electrified. All the power comes from the sun. 45 kilowatts of panels on the roof, and everything works out of the sun for the next 25 years, so long as the sun shines. I have no problem with power. But the beauty is, that it was installed by a priest, a Hindu priest who's only done 8 years of primary schooling. Never been to school, never been to college. He knows more about solar than anyone I know anywhere in the world. Guaranteed. Food, if you come to the Barefoot College, is solar cooked. But the people who fabricated that solar cooker are women. Illiterate women who actually fabricate the most sophisticated solar cooker. It's a parabolic Scheffler solar cooker. Unfortunately, they're almost half German. They're so precise. You'll never find Indian women so precise. Absolutely to the last inch, they can make that cooker. And we have 60 meals twice a day of solar cooking. We have a dentist. She's a grandmother, illiterate, who's a dentist. She actually looks after the teeth of 7,000 children. Barefoot technology. This was 1986. No engineer, no architect thought of it, but we are collecting rainwater from the roofs. Very little water is wasted. All the roofs are connected underground to a 400,000-liter tank, and no water is wasted. If we have 4 years of drought, we still have water in the campus because we collect rainwater. 60% of children don't go to school because they have to look after animals, sheep, goats, domestic chores. So we thought of starting a school at night for the children. We call the night schools of Thelonia. Over 75,000 children have gone through these night schools because it's for the convenience of the child. It's not for the convenience of the teacher. And what do we teach in these schools? Democracy, citizenship, how you should measure your land, what you should do if you're arrested, what you should do if your animal is sick. This is what we teach in the night schools. But all the schools are solar lit. Every 5 years, we have an election between 6 to 14-year-old children participate in a democratic process, and they elect a prime minister. The prime minister is 12 years old. He looks after 20 goats in the morning, but she's prime minister in the evening. She has a cabinet, Minister for Education, Minister for Energy, Minister for Health, and they actually monitor and supervise 150 schools for 7,000 children. She got the World's Children's Prize 5 years ago, and she went to Sweden. First time ever going out of a village, never seen Sweden, wasn't dazzled at all by what was happening. And the Queen of Sweden, who's there, turned to me and said, can you ask this child where she got her confidence from? She's only 12 years old and she's not dazzled by anything. And the girl who's on her left turned to me and looked at the Queen straight in the eye and said, please tell her I'm the Prime Minister. Where this percentage of illiteracy is very high, we use puppetry. Puppet is the way we communicate. You have
Hey, welcome back to the channel, everyone. It's time to talk about the elephant in the country, Detroit, Michigan. Unless you've been in a coma for 20 years, you know Detroit has seen some dark times. Detroit was once a booming auto manufacturing city. That's how it got its nickname, the Motor City. The boom started to fizzle in the 1980s when some CEO types decided they could turn a quicker buck by shipping American jobs overseas. Now, this left the auto workers high and dry. And this is known in the business world as a dick move. Detroit in the last few years has been trying to make a comeback, and they've got a long road to go. They've got some scary neighborhoods they need to fix, and that's what this list is all about, the bad neighborhoods. Quick disclaimer, this list is done by stats alone. We're just going by stats on this one. And another thing, most people in Detroit like to refer to the neighborhoods by their cross streets, the major streets. I'm going to actually use the name of the neighborhood. So in case you want to look it up later on, you can. It's easier to find that way. It's next to impossible to find these neighborhoods by their cross streets. So let's get going. Here's my top 10 worst neighborhoods in Detroit. Number 10, Boynton Oakwood Heights. Boynton and Oakwood Heights are the southernmost neighborhoods of the city of Detroit. Now, there's two separate neighborhoods, but most people kind of see them as one, and they both suck. These places bump right up against an industrial area, and of course, this has raised some health concern for the residents living in Boynton Oakwood Heights for years. This, like so many other neighborhoods in Detroit, has seen a mass exodus from these areas. People just don't live there anymore. They move out. They have about 800 vacant homes right now. The banks don't even put up for sale signs anymore. The people have been taking them down and using them to heat their homes in the winter. It scores an F in all categories but cost of living, of course, because if no one wants to live there, it's pretty cheap to live there. Here's some fun facts. The overall crime rate in Boynton Oakwood Heights is 209% higher than the national average, and the unemployment rate is 94% higher than the national average. Number 9, Riverdale. Riverdale is in the northwest section of Detroit. This Riverdale is not like the Riverdale you see on that cheesy Archie comic mutation on the CW these days. This place is dirty, it's dangerous, and it's depressing. This is the type of place you move to if your life really hasn't worked out for you and you've just given up. Here's some good news. You can get a house on the cheap. Here's a screenshot from Zillow. That one for $6K? Yeah, you're probably going to have to move the body of the old owner yourself for that price. I can't believe you can buy a house for $6,000. Here's some fun facts. The overall crime rate in Riverdale is 227% higher than the national average. This one is startling. Only 66% of the people in Riverdale have completed the 8th grade. Wow. Number 8, Griggsdale.
Across from the Palmer Park Golf Course is one of Detroit's most rundown neighborhoods, Grixdale. And I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing that wrong. I'm not from there. This list is done basically off stats and news reports. The only reason you go here to Grixdale is if you're bargain shopping for hookers. Some streets, such as Robinwood, are more than 80% abandoned and often the target of arson. Not even arson for insurance, arson for fun or warmth. Here's some fun facts. The unemployment in Grixdale is 244% higher than the national average. The average rent ask is 48% lower than the national average. Number 7. Carbon Works. Besides having a very industrial-sounding name, Carbon Works residents share their little piece of heaven with the Detroit Water and Sewage Plant and is across the Rogue River from the ever-so-toxic Zug Island. Most towns pray for good weather, good schools, low crime. Carbon Works residents just pray the wind doesn't change direction while they're eating. Here's some fun facts. The overall crime rate in Carbon Works is 252% higher than the national average. The unemployment rate in Carbon Works is 72% higher than the national average. Number 6. Briggs. Briggs is a nightmare. Now, this is the neighborhood in Detroit called Briggs. Not me. Now, I'm sure if you talked to anyone I dated back in the day, they'd probably say I was a nightmare too. But this video is about my problems. It's about Detroit's problems. Briggs is also known as North Corktown, or it's kind of next to North Corktown. They kind of bleed into one another. The first thing you notice about Briggs, strange amount of open land. Detroit started bulldozing vacant houses some years back, and Briggs was filled with them. So now you have like one house on a block that used to hold like 20. The rest is just empty fields. It's really eerie and it's really strange looking. I encourage you to Google map it. It's pretty weird. Here's some fun facts. The overall crime rate in Briggs is 263% higher than the national average. There's hardly anyone there. Who's committing all these crimes? The average home price in Briggs is 88% lower than the national average. See? Cheap land. That's one bright spot about Briggs. This place is a nightmare. Number 5. Poletown East. Poletown was named after the Polish immigrants who originally lived in the area. It almost sounds like a racial slur, Poletown. But I guess Poles even call themselves Poles, so I guess it's okay. Maybe not. Moving on. A portion of the residential area known as Poletown became General Motors Detroit Assembly Plant in 1981, with those residents being relocated by General Motors. And the city of Detroit claimed eminent domain and took over the land. The plant is still there and employs 1,800 people. It did add an additional 1,200 jobs back in 2015, but then eliminated them like 12 months later. Now, this is another neighborhood filled with vacant lots. It's one of those ones you see like two houses where there used to be 20 and the rest is just, you know, growth. It's not even like building growth, like bushes and stuff. You'd be surprised what you find in those bushes. Here's some fun facts. The overall crime rate in Poletown East is 218% higher than the national average, and the unemployment rate in Poletown East is 175% higher than the national average. Number 4. Spring Wells Village. Spring Wells Village is a neighborhood in southwestern Detroit near the Ford Motor Company plant. Blah, blah, blah. Let's get the meat and potatoes of this place. It's right up the road from Carbon Works, and I'm sure with the right wind, you can catch a glorious whiff of the sewage plant. I read an article about the neighborhood and the smell of the sewage plant. This lady claimed that only out-of-town people even notice the smell. Now, that's kind of like some kind of Stockholm syndrome or something like that. She's just gotten used to it and you've learned to live with it. And you start sympathizing with the sewage plant. It's weird. If you look at this neighborhood, it doesn't look that bad compared to some of the other areas that I've shown you. They do have the vacant lots, not as many. They do have a whole lot of boarded up houses, not as many as some of the other places, but it still has a lot of crime. A lot of those crimes are burglaries, robberies, and like home invasions. And basically, since this is one of the better neighborhoods of the bad neighborhoods, I think they're drawing in more crime. This is just my opinion. I think they're probably drawing in more crime from the outside area to this area. I saw some videos on crime that was going on there. It's pretty bad, especially for the elderly. Here's some fun facts. The overall crime rate in Spring Wells is 246% higher than the national average. The median household income in Spring Wells is 45% lower than the national average. Here's a staggering staggering stat. Only 50.9% of the people in Springwell have completed the 8th grade. Wow. Number 3, Northwest Goldberg. Normally when something has the word gold in it, it's a good thing. This place ain't normal. Far from it. This place is run down to say the least. Take a look at this place on Google Street View. And by the way, that's the only way I recommend anyone experience Northwest Goldberg. The area is home to the Motown Museum, and it has the Henry Ford Hospital on its border, which is an impressive building. Take a look at that, again, on Google Street View. Still, I find it hard to believe that anyone still lives here. I did come across a website that said it's getting better in Northwest Goldberg, and someday we'll return to a great place to raise kids. Someday, maybe. Today, not so much. Most kids today in Northwest Goldberg don't get a bedtime story. Instead, they get their Miranda rights read in the back of a patrol car. Good times in Goldberg. Here's some fun facts. The overall crime rate in Northwest Goldberg is 246% higher than the national average, and the unemployment rate in Northwest Goldberg is 96% higher than the national average. Woo! Number 2, State Fairgrounds and Chaldean Town. These two are right next to each other and are both hellholes. The State Fairgrounds has almost no residents but plenty of crime, and Chaldean Town used to have a good-sized Chaldean community, so they named the neighborhood after them. It's now known as North Town by some, seeing that most of the Chaldeans have skipped town. Today, most of the homes and businesses are vacant and need to be torn down, but are mostly boarded up or burnt out. This place is a step above a ghost town. So bad that maybe that show Ghost Hunters could do an episode or two here. I'd love to see that episode, as they try and contact the ghost of Maurice the Crackhead, talk to him for about a half hour. That would be terrific. Here's some fun facts. The overall crime rate in Chaldean Town and State Fairgrounds is 282% higher than the national average. Nice going. The unemployment rate in Chaldean Town is 184% higher than the national average. Words of advice, don't go here. And number 1, Petoskey Otsego. Petoskey Otsego is one of those places that nobody ever tells you that's where they're from. I came across some videos about how you can get cheap houses here from the government or from the city of Detroit, and in all the videos, they never say it's in Petoskey Otsego. They always say things like it's a with a view of this neighborhood or walking distance from this neighborhood, a half a mile from this neighborhood. They never mention the neighborhood. And for good reason. AreaVibes.com gave it the lowest score I have ever seen, a 41. And it says it's barely livable. I saw another one that was barely livable, but at least that one had like a 46 score. This one's a 41. And that's not good. The street view on Google Maps is depressing to say the least. When I look at it, I think to myself, oh, that's what our country will look like if our government ever collapses. The best way to describe this place is eyesore. Now, I said that they're trying to sell these houses, and they sell them for really cheap. Here's some quick snapshots of the Zillow page for Petoskey Otsego. Them some low prices, but I don't think it's worth it. This place is dangerous. I actually feel sorry for the residents of the place. I feel sorry for a lot of the residents, a lot of these neighborhoods. I don't feel sorry for like the homeless and the criminals that live there. They chose this place. Some of these poor people are elderly and they've lived there forever and they've got no way out. They've just hoped for the best. And that's the most depressing part about this. Here's some fun facts. The overall crime rate in Petoskey Otsego is 252% higher than the national average. This is a small neighborhood. The unemployment rate in Petoskey Otsego is 195% higher than the national average. They've got like 5,000 residents, and I think 12 of them have jobs, if I'm reading this correctly. It's not that bad, but pretty close. All right, everyone, that's my top 10 worst neighborhoods in Detroit. I hope you enjoyed it. Hope you got some information out of it. Hope you got some laughs out of it. Now, this one was requested for a very long time, and I put it off for a long time because I've never been to Detroit. This whole video was statistically driven. I went by stats only. So I'm sure people from Detroit or that have some experience are going to have some complaints. Maybe the way I pronounced the neighborhood, or you think this neighborhood should be before that neighborhood, whatever. Like I said, this one was statistically driven, and I apologize if I mispronounced anything. I tried. The people of Detroit and the city of Detroit have been through the ringer over the last couple decades. Hopefully, they'll be able to pull themselves out of it. It's a great city with great people. Maybe someday. They deserve it. But as always, have a great night and be nice to each other.